There are, I believe, about 1,000 food banks in North America, serving billions of pounds of surplus food through thousands of relief agencies to millions of hungry people. This effort leads us to ask, can the poor be nourished out of poverty?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Hello out there. You are tuned into the 938th edition of the Food Chain Radio program right here on News Talk Radio. Or, hey, perhaps you're among our friends over there in Beaujolais who are tuned in as we stream along in the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio with engineer Aaron Shore on the boards. Hello, Aaron.
Hello there.
Aaron, I have a question for you.
I may have an answer.
Can the poor be nourished out of poverty?
I'm not sure.
That's an answer. You gave me an answer. And thanks to producer Kelly Bayer for putting this show together today with a very interesting guest. Folks, on January 8th of 1964, President Lyndon Johnson declared an unconditional war on poverty in America. Since then, the United States has spent about $12 trillion fighting poverty. Yet despite this unconditional war of money on poverty, the percentage of people in poverty has stayed pretty much the same. In fact, the number of people needing help is increasing, not decreasing. Here in the good old land of milk and honey, U.S. of A., for example, over 100 million people are now on government support. That's darn near one-third of the entire population on government support. To help alleviate the pain of all this poverty, here in North America, there are about 1,000 food banks serving billions of pounds of surplus food through thousands of relief agencies to millions of hungry people. These food banks are based on the very simple principle that surplus food should be deposited in a central facility from which it can be withdrawn by those in hunger. Now, given the number of food banks, the billions of pounds of food they bank, the tens of thousands of agencies that distribute the food, and the hundreds of millions of government support on government support, and above all, that $12 trillion we have spent on poverty, we simply must ask, can the poor be nourished out of poverty? Today we travel to Toronto in search of an answer, and here to help us in that search we have Nick Saul, who is a co-author of a book entitled The Stop. Nick, welcome to the Food Chain.
Thanks for having me on. 938 shows. Proud to be on it.
Hey, I'm happy to have you here. I was happy to be a guest of your wonderful city, Toronto, last year. I was up speaking at the Urban Agriculture Conference they had at Ryerson there. And I had an opportunity to attend a great big banquet at one of your facilities, I believe. You call it the barn or something?
That's right. It's called the Green Barn, and it's centrally located in downtown Toronto.
And what a city Toronto is! I had an opportunity to take a long walk along an avenue and through many different neighborhoods. And what totally amazed me is that how many million people live there?
We're about 2.5 million.
There's 2.5 million people in Toronto, and no two of them are of the same color.
Yeah, it's a pretty amazing city in that respect. Really diverse, about the most diverse city you'll find on the planet.
I think you're right. It was truly amazing. It was just every kind of food you could possibly imagine, from every kind of person. It was really kind of a fun experience to spend some time in your wonderful town, talking about food, no less. And that's what we're here to do today. You're the author of a book entitled The Stop, but it started with a food bank, right, called The Stop.
That's right. Well, you're just talking about the great food scene we have in Toronto, and of course that food scene reflects the many, many cultures that make up this great city, but there's also many thousands of people who really struggle to put food on their table. So I've been working in that part of the food food movement, trying to increase people's access to healthy, good food in a dignified way for a long time. And you've just mentioned the book called The Stop, How the Fight for Good Food Transformed a Community and Inspired a Movement that I wrote with my wife, kind of chronicles my 14 years at The Stop Community Food Center fighting for greater justice for lots of our community members.
An interesting account, too. It's kind of like an over-the-shoulders, like somebody following you with a camera. Kind of read. It's interesting to follow you through that process of I guess rebuilding a food bank into something else. Would that be a fair description?
Absolutely. I think we have built it into a completely different species than what we think of when we think of a food bank. And when I got there in the late 90s, 1998, it was not unlike thousands of food banks across North America, people lining out the door and literally having to check their humanity at the door once they walked in, and once they got in, keeping their eyes on the floor and making their way to the front of a line and being handed a hamper of not very healthy food, often fat, sugar, and salt, which is generally the kind of food that shows up in a lot of food banks.
And convenience stores.
A dispiriting experience for thousands of people.
Well, I have a, before we get into the food bank and the stop and the whole change that you have affected up there with respect to charity of food, you know, we've had this great war on poverty, and, you know, the government, our government down here in the U.S. has spent over $16 trillion on fixing poverty, on the war on poverty. And yet, the rate of poverty hasn't changed at all. Maybe a point or two here and there, but essentially, it's the same as it was when we started. So what on earth is going on?
Well, we've had a massive shift in the way our economy works, away from a lot of good-paying, unionized, good-benefit jobs in the manufacturing sector to the onslaught of a service sector economy that creates very vulnerable jobs and doesn't pay them very well. And so, I mean, that has been a massive change over the last 25, 35 years.
But even that hasn't changed the percentage. I guess that we're spending.
No, it's created more vulnerable workers who, I mean, yeah. You know, the experience that I have working in very low income communities over lots of years is that many people, in fact, are working. They're working two or three jobs to try and put food on the table or realize whatever hopes and dreams they have, and they simply can't make ends meet given the low wages that they're receiving. So, I mean, I think in the U.S., where minimum wages are extraordinarily low, I think that is a significant area to be pushing and driving on, that we need to increase minimum wages so that people who are working hard, I mean, there was this old adage that if you had a job, you'd work your way out of poverty, and that's simply not the case these days. So, and I'm not even talking about the kind of federal assistance and state assistance programs that need to be there when people fall out of the economy to try and leverage them back in, because that's where people want to be. People want to be working and contributing.
So maybe it is that the foundation of the economy, which is, you know, good jobs, is eroding, and so we keep spending more and more and more money from people to maintain where we were or something, and that's why the rate of poverty stays the same. It's still right there around 15-16% as it was when we started the Great War on Poverty. So I'm just thinking, maybe we're not doing something right.
Well, certainly, I mean, I can say on the job front, if we're going to be creating jobs for people, we need to create jobs that allow people, when they do work 35, 45, 50 hours a week, that they earn enough that they can make ends meet. And that's simply not the case. You can work full-time at a minimum wage and still be well below the poverty line. And I think that that is a serious problem. I mean, I've been excited to see the mobilizing in the U.S. around restaurant workers, fast food employees, and how low their wages are. And I think that, things change when you fight for it. That's a key theme in our book. And I think the more politicized, not partisan, but the more politicized we are about thinking very clearly about good public policy, the better off all of us will be. There's a lot of research that shows that social distancing between people, i.e. the gap between rich and poor, which is very, very big in both Canada and the U.S., the closer, that the more you reduce that gap, the healthier, more environmentally sounder our economies and society.
That was the principle behind the, you know, or at least the benefit of having a great middle class was that when the distance wasn't so great, people were much more happy, or so it would seem. Now that gap is becoming larger and larger and larger. And in spite of the fact that we're spending $16 trillion to try to fix it. And so it's something is just not quite clicking along the way. And we're going to try to figure out today whether we can use food to change that. And here to help us, we have Nick Saul, who is the co-author of, with his wife Andrea, of a book entitled The Stop, about the effort up in Toronto to turn a food bank into, honey, what would you call it, Nick?
Well, it's a center where we use the power of food to create health and hope and self-worth and sustainability and greater equity.
So stay tuned, folks. We will be right back, and it's going to be fun.
Okay.
Get this. You can earn a 5, 6, or 7-figure income by farming a small parcel of land in or near the city. You can be old or young, rich or poor, married or single. You can rent, lease, or own. You can farm small fruits on prairie bench lands, houseplants in coastal valleys, flowers on steep wooded hillsides, vegetables in city green belts, ornamentals in neighborhoods of million-dollar homes. There's only one catch. You must compete with other farmers for the consumer dollars. You can compete with others and win the consumer dollars with the help of MetroFarm, the guide to growing for profit in or near the city. MetroFarm is the Ben Franklin Book of the Year Award winner that will guide you step by step through the planning and development of your very own income-generating metropolitan farm. Abraham Lincoln said the greatest fine art of the future will be the making of a comfortable living on a small parcel of land. Get in on the future today. Get a copy of MetroFarm at www.metrofarm.com.
Well, here's a question for you. Do you think that we can use food to nourish people out of poverty? Well, that's a tough one, but Nick Saul took it on at The Stop up in Toronto. The Stop started out as a food bank. Nick, let's talk a little bit about food banks, because actually they're a relatively new form of social institution. Started, I guess, in the early 1980s, correct?
Yeah, that's right. They came on in force in the late 70s, early 80s, always meant to be temporary, but became institutionalized over many, many years. And I think as part of that process, we've sometimes forgotten that hunger is not about a lack of food. There is plenty of food out there. In fact, we throw out about 30 to 40% of the food we produce. But hunger is about poverty, and people simply don't have enough income to make ends meet.
Did you say that we throw out 30 to 40% of the food we manufacture?
Absolutely. That's it's an enormous number. Some of that is in the field. Some of that is in transportation. Some of that is not sold in the supermarket. And some of it is dies in our fridge. Mm-hmm. When we decide maybe to buy some food and then go out for dinner two nights in a row, and guess what? That food doesn't last. So Carlo Petrini of Slow International talks about the fridge as the coffin. It's where food goes to die. So we throw out an enormous amount of food, and in spite of that, we have billions in the world who are going hungry.
Yeah, there it is. Well, that's the kind of the equation. So the concept then of a food bank is that it's a facility in which we deposit surplus food so that those in need may withdraw it. Is that correct?
Yeah, and we have said that, I think our story is about saying that the food bank isn't good enough, and that's something that we asked some very honest questions to our community back in the late 1990s. Does the food bank reduce hunger? Does it improve health? Does it create pathways out of poverty? And the answer to all of those questions was no, with a capital N. And then we asked some other questions. Does the food bank stigmatize and make people feel small? Does it divide us as citizens between the haves and the have-nots? And I think maybe even most importantly, does it create a moral release valve for all of us, including including government, to say the problem is being taken care of. And the answer to those questions is that's not the case. They do stigmatize people, they do divide us, and they are taking everyone off the hook. So we had a big problem on our hands when I started at this place back in the 1990s, and through relentless incrementalism, we built a very different kind of organization that was all about health and dignity and respect and using the power of food to change people's lives and also the health of the community more generally.
Well, but going back to the original food bank, wasn't the idea always just simply to have enough food, you know, to get food to them?
Yeah, but I mean, other than a very temporary relief for a couple of days, the food bank is not answering those problems. And so for a lot of people, I think the food bank is seen as the embodiment of a good deed. And I think the approach that we've taken in the work we're doing in low-income communities around food is that they're in fact a symbol of a breakdown of our social fabric and an end of whatever collective understanding we have about our responsibility to each other. Because ultimately, you know, hunger is not related to how much food is out there. It's related to people having good jobs, affordable housing, affordable health care and child care, having income in their pocket. And so we've used our centers to build a community that, of course, uses the power of food to connect with each other, to eat well all the time. We have a huge priority.
Let me back up just a little bit, because I'd like to explore this just a little more so that people can get a firm grip of what you're talking about. I saw an article recently about how Walmart donates $2 billion a year in food to food banks around the nation.
Right.
And then I read this from you. Mm-hmm. Charitable food banks, it turns out, are good for the corporate food donors who save on dumping fees and cultivate social capital. Good for well-meaning volunteers who feel good about helping the needy. Politicians who point to them as evidence the problem is being dealt with. Everyone except the people they were set up to help. And with respect to corporations, I was at our local food bank recently, which is the second oldest here in the United States, and an incredible institution in its own right. And we were going through it, and one of the people there who is intimately connected with the food industry, used to work at a big giant supermarket chain, was explaining how the donation, the corporate donations work. And he said that what they do is that these corporations, when food is no longer ripe for the shelves, as it were, they will charge it back to the people from whom they purchased it, the vendor. And then they will actually charge the vendors for writing it down and sending it. But instead of sending it back to them, they'll donate it to a food bank. So they're actually making money coming and going on that. Does that sound...
Well, I just think if we stand away from the immediate issue and like, really, do we think that this is a way to solve hunger? It becomes a logistical question of how we move food that isn't sold in the marketplace or maybe is going off, and the poor become the garburators of that food. I need to be really careful when I say this, because I'm in no way trying to villainize the food bank sector. I am just suggesting that we need to channel the compassion and that human urge to help others that is in such evidence within the food bank world into a more progressive project where we see food much more holistically and not simply as a commodity, that we see food as a way to build health, to think about the implications of how food moves from field to table from an environmental perspective, for example, to create places where we're actually talking about the structural issues that drive vulnerability in the first place, like things we've already talked about, low minimum wages and healthcare that's very expensive, or the myriad of things that are really at the root of why people are poor. People are not poor because they're poor budgeters or it's a lifestyle choice.
Well, some are.
Well, I disagree. I've worked for 20 years in low-income communities.
And they're all good budgeters and good planners?
Yeah, I think people want to succeed. They I mean, the people who are middle class and poor. I'm sure you can find some segments that are not good budgeters, but people aren't poor because they're not good budgeters. The reasons why people are poor are the ones I'm trying to describe, and I think we need to keep that central in our minds. And having a food bank system that shovels food that doesn't get sold toward people who are poor, I don't think is an answer. No one thinks that private charity is the solution to hunger. No one. You wouldn't catch anyone saying that.
Yeah, and then, you know, and that's kind of what I was trying to get at. Going back to their original intent, it was all meant to be a very temporary stopgap thing. But you and others like you seem to be suggesting that food banks are kind of becoming the instrument of government and industry as a way of holding off real change, as it were.
Yeah, I think that we need to have an honest conversation about that. And at some point, I mean, there are many, many food banks. And I should make the distinction on this show. There is a difference in the U.S. Between food bank and food pantry. So in Canada, we use the word interchangeably, food bank, food pantry. I, for many years, ran what in the U.S. would be called a food pantry, a very small, community-based, handing out food to people directly who came walking through the door, which is very different than a food bank in the U.S., which is usually a big operation that is a central distribution hub for food that then gets sent out to pantries across the state.
Yeah, our local food bank serves like 200 what you would call food
That's
pantries.
Right.
Yeah, so there's a...
So we should just make that distinction. And so, I mean, I think back in the early days of food banking, most people said these will be here for a very short amount of time. Here in Canada, the National Association of Food Banks put in a sunset clause into its constitution that it would wrap up in 3 years and push this back onto
government. And they're still here. Can you hold that for just a sec?
Yeah.
We have to take a quick break. Folks, can we feed people and get them out of poverty? 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. Folks, we the people have been having an all-out war on poverty. We spent $16 trillion as a government to fight poverty, and yet we still have pretty much the same amount of people in poverty that we had when we started. What the heck is going on? Is there another way of doing this? Well, Nick Saul seems to think so. Listen what he says. There is a better way. Instead of stigmatizing and dividing us as citizens, let's use food as an agent of change. Wow, that sounds exciting, Nick. How the heck are we going to do it?
Well, what we're trying to do in our humble contribution to the debate around how people should access good food is we're building centers where people come together around a good meal, and through that meal, they get a sense of a sense of hope and self-worth, which I think are fundamental to both individual and community change. And we create these spaces where people are met directly where they need to be met. They need food. We make sure that they have really good food. But really our work is about trying to involve them in some of the larger structural issues that are driving their vulnerability in the first place. And I'm talking about low minimum wages. I'm talking about inadequate welfare. I'm talking in the U.S. about the attack on food stamps that the House Republicans are pushing right now, $40 billion over 10 years. I mean, these
are... Well, you know, with all due respect to them, what we have here is a situation of a government that's trillions and trillions in the hole, and it has 100 million people on the dole. So we have to do something different. Something different has to be. And what you're talking about, take me back to that point. You know, you had a food pantry, which is like, you know, there are 200 of them in our community that hand out food to the poor. But you have this notion that something debilitating takes place when one hands food to another.
Well, think about charity. Charity is a really interesting word. If you're the giver of charity, it's altruism, it's love in the Bible, it's compassion. And it feels really good. If you're the receiver of charity, it often makes you feel smaller and embarrassed and stigmatized. So I think it is possible to create spaces where charity happens, but it happens in a really dignified, respectful space where that us and them is rubbed away, and that it's not about charity, but it's about solidarity.
So this is
what we have tried to do with food in the community food centers mm-hmm. we're building, not only in Toronto, but now across the country through this new organization called Community Food Centers Canada.
So this is a fundamental shift in thinking about food charity then, right? I guess I have this little saying in the beginning of my Metro Farm book, and it goes something like, give me a fish and I will eat today. Teach me to fish and I will eat always.
Yeah, you can think about it in those terms. All we're trying to do is create generous, dignified spaces that never says that the work that a food pantry is doing is solving hunger. It can create a place where people can meet and have a sense of their connection. But these places also have to be focused on those larger issues that are the reason why people are walking through the door in the first place. And that's what we've been doing in our centers. Mm-hmm. It's this marriage of direct service in a very dignified way, very healthy food, and we have a strong focus on a local regional food economy. Some of our biggest customers are the farms that are producing food in a way that is good for the planet and good for our bodies.
So you're actually patronizing local farms then?
Absolutely. We do it in a number of ways. I mean, we run one of the biggest farmers markets in the city. 1,000 people a week come through it. We sell $2-3 million a year worth of food, so that supports many, many small farmers that are doing mixed crop farming. Central, close to Toronto, that's really key in our mandate. And we also prioritize good food in all the many programs we run, whether that's in a drop-in meal or, in fact, in the food bank that we still continue to run. We've just focused very strongly on healthier food, more culturally mm-hmm. appropriate food, and more food, quite frankly.
You know, looking back to when you first took over the food pantry, what was your wake-up moment when you actually said, geez, what we're doing is not working?
The moment was when, because in those days we had no staff, and so I worked 2 days a week in the food pantry itself, and when a Somali mom with three kids showed up at the front of the line, and we had not very good food to give her, certainly not enough, and it didn't measure up to the cultural foods that she was looking for. And it was pretty clear to me that we were a big, big Band-Aid, and we weren't helping her, nor the thousands of others that were walking through the door. And, you know, the way it changed, and it's always amazing to me that this doesn't happen more, is that we simply listened. We were good listeners in those early days, and people were pretty clear, very clear, that the food bank wasn't cutting it for them.
How were they clear? What did they say to you?
They said, we want to be cooks, we want to be gardeners, we want to be engaged citizens, we want to be volunteers, we want to be part of trying to improve our individual lives, but also the life of this community.
So there was a desire, really, to be part of a solution rather than the problem.
Yeah, I mean, I often walk into food banks in my travels, or food pantries, I should say, and food banks, where there is this kind of, you know, we're the volunteers and we're going to give you the food. But I would say, well, why not have people who actually use the service part of the volunteer body? Mm-hmm. There are very simple things that you can do to try and erase this charitable problem we talked about earlier. And fundamentally, you have to be speaking out about why people are poor in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
And that's about poverty, and it's about income.
You know what you were saying. What you were saying about wages really rang too. We were, in my recent tour of the local food bank. There was a big flat of strawberries, yeah. A big stack of strawberries, and the gentleman said, "You know, the great irony here is that the people who pick these strawberries are going to be the people who receive them through this food bank." The people who are out there in the fields, you know, aren't making enough to get by. So they have to get the strawberries from the food bank in this charity.
Henry Ford understood that you needed to pay people a good wage so that they could actually consider purchasing the product that they were producing. And I think the issue of fairness in the field and fair wages is a big one.
How did you go about starting the change? What was your first step?
Well, it was what I just said. It was listening.
It
was as simple as that. We spent a lot of nights inviting people to come in over a good meal to talk about what they thought our center could be. And as I said, when you ask people what they're thinking, they have a lot to say. And we couldn't do it overnight because we were literally $200,000 and three staff and lots of volunteers, but we didn't have a lot of resources, and we were in a place that was physically falling apart.
So then, when we get back from this quick break, sure. I want to ask you what you did then. I mean, you listened to them. They told you, we want to be part of something. We want to be part of a solution. We don't want to be the problem. We want to be part of a solution. What did you do then? This is The Food Chain. Michael Olson, Nick Saul, and you, right back. 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080.
Great shot, Bob. I think you're on.
I just followed your lead.
Hey, by the way, did you break ground on your new building?
No way. I'm holding off until I see what the future holds.
So you're seeing a fortune teller?
You know what I mean. Things look a little uncertain.
The only thing certain in business is if you're not growing, you're losing. And we just opened our fifth facility last week. If you're following my lead, you'll call General Steel. Their pre-engineered steel buildings could save you as much as half the cost compared to conventional buildings. And they're up in nearly half the time. And back with a 50-year structural warranty.
Yeah, but steel buildings...
Hey, you've seen my building. Does it look like steel?
No, it looks great.
Ask about rebates that could save you up to $20,000. Look, you can stop paying rent and own a building that suits your business better and probably saves you money by operating more efficiently. In times like these, don't stop spending, just spend wisely.
Call 800-965-1290, 800-965-1290, 800-965-1290.
This is Nnamdi Asamoah. I play football for the Philadelphia Eagles, but what I do off the field with United Way might be more important. I'm a volunteer tutor and mentor. Why? Because over a million kids a year drop out of school, and that's not okay. It takes 12 years to create a graduate, but it takes about the same time to create a dropout. And the difference between a child becoming one or the other could be me, or it could be you. Studies show that if we get to these kids earlier, their chances are better. And kids who read well by third grade are more likely to graduate. So join me in United Way. Suit up and take the pledge. Become a volunteer reader, tutor, or mentor. Because when a child succeeds, we all succeed. Give. Advocate. Volunteer. Live United. Take the pledge at unitedway.org. Brought to you by United Way, the Ad Council, and the National Football League.
I shoved the envelope under my sweater and sneaked to the kitchen. Mom was on the phone in the front room. I didn't want to have to explain anything. I just wanted to be by myself. Clutching the envelope tightly, I stepped onto the ladder at the bottom of the treehouse. Something caught my eye above me, and I looked up. Light! It looked as if there were a firework display going on inside the treehouse. Crackling and snapping and whizzing sounds spun around above my head. Light shot out in sparks, dancing to the popping of noise. My first thought was to scream fire and run to the house to get Mom. My legs trembled as I inched upward, creeping up the rungs as quietly as I could. My heart banged so hard that it felt as if someone were hitting my chest. A couple more steps, and then I leaned forward, craning my neck to look inside. And then I looked up and saw... To find out what happens next, read Philippa Fisher's Fairy Godsister by Liz Kessler. Explore new worlds and check out more cool books at your local library. And visit read.gov. Brought to you by the Library of Congress and the Ad Council.
Imagine spending $16 trillion to fix a problem and not getting anything done. That's exactly what's happened in our war on poverty. $16 trillion to fix poverty, but poverty is still the same level as it was when we started. Must be a better way. Maybe we can do it ourselves right here in our own hometown. maybe we can use food as the vehicle. That seems to be the suggestion put forth in The Stop by Nick Saul and Andrea Curtis, how the fight for good food transformed a community and inspired a movement. How did you start? You listened to your constituents, which were people who were hungry and people who were in poverty. They told you that they wanted to be part of the solution and not the problem. What did you do then, Nick?
Well, I mean, I think there's many ways to cut that, but I'll give you an example that when we were starting to try and figure out how to build beyond the transactional food bank that we had, where people walked to the front of the line, were handed not very healthy food, we started to think about gardening. There were lots of people in our community who came from with agriculture in their DNA and their background. And so we hooked up with the local Parks and Rec Department. They had an area in the park that they weren't using, and we said we'd like to build a community garden there. And it started as a 3,000 square foot spot. It turned into 5, then 7, then 8, then 10. And really what happened there was it was less about the food, although the food was obviously important, but it was about reducing people's isolation and having a place where people could feel comfortable. So, for example, a Bangladeshi guy who just arrived in Canada could figure out what to grow in this climate and take it back to his windowsill or his backyard. We started to work with classrooms around the neighborhood. Kids would come and plant seeds and then come back and harvest them in September, and they learned that food didn't grow on supermarket shelves, but it actually needed water, sun, and good soil. We had harvest parties that brought the community together. We went on strawberry and farm and corn picking trips. One of the fellows who lived in the community and became very, very connected to the garden. He was an unemployed guy in his 50s, and he was from Jamaica, and he saw some other volunteers picking out callaloo as a weed, and he came rushing and said, "That's not a weed, that's callaloo." And 2 weeks later, he cooked that food for a big group of people at our community center, and with saltfish and ackee and callaloo. And it became clear to me in that moment that one person's weed is another person's delicacy, and that food is never just food. So, I mean, the story there is that we built something very, very differently. And guess what? When you create something that is making a difference in people's lives, funding comes to that. And so we were able to convince a number of foundations to get behind that project. And we did that similarly with our fresh market stands and our community.
Isn't it amazing how people love to contribute to something that actually works?
Well, that's, I think, a really powerful thing to remember. We're all looking to find meaning in our lives, and when you find something that is making a difference, guess what? People come to that. They're attracted to it. And that, I mean, I think it must be very difficult for an aging group of volunteers, particularly in the food pantries, because, you know, that's a constituency that has been working very, very hard in this field for many, many years.
Yeah.
And they don't see a lot of victories because people come in, they receive their food, and they go home.
Well, in all due respects, it's the difference between giving a person a fish and teaching them to fish, right?
Yeah, I mean, to me, I think that's one way to translate it. To me, it's just creating a fundamental understanding that everyone has something to contribute. Mm-hmm. And people should not be seen as passive recipients of food charity, but as people who want to grow, who want to cook, who want to connect with their neighbors. And food is this wonderful way of doing that. I mean, I never think of food as a commodity. I mean, think about it. If you eat it with others, you build connection and love. If through it you can express your background and your culture. If you eat good food, you're healthy and alive. If you grow it sustainably without chemicals, you nourish the soil and our planet. And if everyone has access to food in a community, you have a really inclusive, healthy neighborhood. So that's not like a car or a bicycle. That is a powerful thing, and that's what is at the center of our work in these community food centers.
And you mentioned the community garden. I just thought about our local community garden, and in watching what happens when one person plants something in one bed and his or her neighbor plants something different in the next bed, and there's something really interesting that happens. There's a communication and a learning process. Yeah. Like you said, about one person's weed is another person's delicacy.
Yeah.
And then what happens, of course, is that there's a surplus in one bed and a surplus in another bed, and you start exchanging things around the garden. And truly amazing things happen. And what a community garden does, in addition to providing a place to grow food, is it really does build a community.
Yeah.
And when you're part of it.
I think that what I've always said is that, I mean, I don't think a community garden is going to solve hunger. It won't. But what it does is it builds relationships. And unless, from our perspective as an organization working in a low-income community, unless you build those relationships, you can't have a conversation with them or encourage them into something around welfare rates being inadequate. You have to have that relationship. If it's all based on a transaction where you don't know anything about their history or their background, when you want them to get involved in some of these other issues that are harder to win, for sure, but needless to say, we need to be engaged on increasing welfare rates or minimum wages or whatever it might be. But it comes from that very basic premise that a relationship has been built. And that happens in gardens. It happens in cooking programs where people plan a meal
together. Okay, we're going to have to take a quick break. When they get back, the big question for you, can the poor be nourished out of poverty? Right back. Stay tuned. Well, there are about 1,000 food banks in North America, somewhere in that neighborhood, serving billions of pounds of surplus food through thousands of relief agencies to millions of hungry people. This effort across the land leads us to ask, can the poor be nourished out of poverty? Who better to ask than Nick Saul, the co-author of The Stop, who's been feeding the hungry for a long, long time, and came to the conclusion that it must be a better way. Instead of stigmatizing and dividing us, he says, let's use food as the agent of change. So, Nick, can we nourish the poor out of poverty?
Well, I think we were just talking about the importance of building relationships in communities, and I think we do a good job of that in the community food center movement we're trying to build here in Canada. And I believe that if we're going to turn the tables on growing inequality, we need to create spaces that are about dignity and respect and coming together. And whether that's coming together in a garden or in a cooking group, that's the only way, by coming together and understanding that collectively we need to fight back and fight for good wages, good schools, affordable health care and housing, adequate social supports when required. I mean, change happens because you fight for it. And so you need to create spaces where people are coming together and saying, this is what needs to change for our lives to be better. And food is a really powerful way to create those connections. So I think as long as you politicize the conversation, not from a partisan perspective, but politicize the conversation and understand good public policy is central to ensuring that everyone has a place at the table, then I think food can be that tool.
Do you think local food can overcome the dominance of politics by industry and government? I mean, do you think that local food can do that?
I think local food is critical as long as it's connected to the equity and the health conversation. We have an agriculture that is all about, and we spend billions of dollars to underwrite this, the political economy of big commodity, monoculture, chemical export is enormous. And I think there is a new generation of farmers who want on the land, who don't want to grow 15,000 acres of corn or soy, but want to grow directly for a marketplace that is local. And they want to do that in a way that's good for the planet and even better for our bodies. So I see a lot of excitement, particularly around the issue of institutional procurement. I've just been following some stuff in New York City where they're really trying to prioritize that our public dollars, when they're spent through various institutions, that it's focused on a local regional food economy. And I think if we can do more of that, we will create the kind of farms that are building health and environmental stewardship. So I'm excited about that local local food movement. It just has to be linked to the fight for access and equity. So all of those issues cannot be isolated. They need to march step together.
Well, there it is. That's from Nick Saul. And what do you think out there? Do you think that food can be used as an instrument of social change to bring justice to the poor, to bring the poor out of poverty? Possible to use food to nourish people out of poverty? That's the question. You can leave an answer what you think at metroform.com. Always curious to hear what you have to say. And above all, thank Nick Saul and Andrea Curtis for writing The Stop and for all the work that you do for taking care of those who are in need. And thank you all for tuning in The Food Chain. Remember, cheap food isn't.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.